In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the history of American secularism. And our guest for the program is Susan Jacoby. We will be talking about her book, Free Thinkers, a book that was first published about a year ago, came out in hardcover in April of 2004, and at the beginning of this year was published in paperback. It's published by Owl Books, which is a division, I believe, of Holt, Henry Holt and Company. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out there and you can find it. We'll be talking a little bit about what she argues are some of the often neglected accomplishments of secularists who have been involved in struggling for reform all the way back to early America and, of course, into the last century. The book looks at some people that are well-known. Certainly, they're well-known names like Jefferson and Madison and Abraham Lincoln, as well as people who have been to us now today largely forgotten. One that I had mentioned here a couple of times this morning is Robert Greene Ingersoll, a man who was said to be the most famous orator in 19th century America. As I say, the book is out now and in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Susan Jacoby. She began her writing career as a reporter for The Washington Post. She is the author of five books, including one titled Wild Justice, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She's also contributed to different publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Nation, TomPaine.com, and the AARP Bulletin. And she is also director of the Center for Inquiry, Metro New York, and makes her home in New York City. And she is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask, again, is occasionally I like to remind people, we just ask callers to try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anybody listening is welcome to join us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Ms. Jacoby, hello.
Yes, hello.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Yes, it's good that you mentioned Ingersoll, you know, since he's an Illinois man, and there's a very nice statue of him in Peoria, in fact.
Oh, indeed. Well, that's I guess that's often, I think, the one of the things that a book like this can do is not only will it remind you of people that you already know about, but it brings back, at least reintroduces people that at one time were very significant individuals, and yet now who knows about them?
Right. Well, unfortunately, I mean, one of the things that's happened with the secular history of America is a lot of it's been forgotten and downgraded. Ingersoll is really a very important man. He was known as the great agnostic in the 19th century. He was a lieutenant governor of Illinois, by the way. And his political career ended because of his anti-clerical, anti-religious views. So he was also a very famous lawyer. And he devoted his life to speaking around the country. This is in the time in the last quarter of the 19th century when Darwin's theory of evolution is first introduced and becoming popularized. He spoke to more people than any American president did. He was very famous. He did many things. He was a man of very great principle. When the Haymarket Square defendants were sentenced to death in Illinois, in Chicago, Ingersoll was asked to defend them at the trial, and he declined because he felt that his well-known agnosticism would work against the defendants in a jury. So he's a very significant figure. It's an absolute crime that he's not included in standard history textbooks.
Well, he apparently, as a speaker, was extremely popular, very great demand. He, for the Times, was paid very significant amount of money just for making one speech.
Yes,
one
that's
night.
That made the right-wing clergy very angry, by the way, that not only did he speak to thousands and thousands of people at a time. When he spoke at the Republican National Convention in 1876, people lined up in a driving rainstorm in the Loop to hear him. The Chicago Tribune reported that there were at least 3,000 people standing outside. But it's very significant. I mean, Ingersoll's thing was separation of church and state, also what he called the bright light of science. But unlike today, the people who went to his lectures didn't necessarily agree with them. What they were willing to do, which seems to be so lost in our society today, is to give a hearing to someone they didn't agree with. Also, of course, lectures, public lectures, were a form of popular entertainment in the pre-television, pre-radio, pre-movie era.
Yeah. So he, obviously, he was extremely popular, and as you say, people would line up to hear him speak, but also hated. And I guess that's I'm wondering if, you know, on balance, was he more hated than was he loved, or was he generally speaking, were his ideas well received, and the number of people who would like to show up and throw things would have been a smaller number.
The number of people who wanted to show up and throw things was large, and certainly the fact that he was an avowed agnostic made it impossible for him to have the major political career, which is, when he died in 1899, the New York Times said this, that his anti-clerical agnostic views denied him the major political career to which his talents would otherwise have richly entitled him. But we don't have anybody like him in public life today. The fact is this man was willing to speak to people honestly. He didn't go around pretending to be religious when he wanted to, because he wanted to be president or he wanted higher office. He spoke honestly, and I think Ingersoll's influence was certainly the majority of Americans did not agree with his anti-religious views. But what he was a voice for rationalism. I think, for instance, he had many friends in the liberal Protestant clergy of its day, and one of the things he was influential in was getting a hearing for things, for example, for people who then as now believed that it was possible to believe in God and still believe in the scientific validity of evolution. And his influence was great, not in persuading people to his agnostic views, but in persuading people of liberal and moderate religious belief to a larger view of the world that admitted science, and also insistence on the separation of church and state as being a benefit to both religion and government.
We'll continue our conversation with Susan Jacoby here in just a moment. I'd like to pass on to people a news bulletin that has just come across our AP news wires. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of detail right at the moment, but AP is reporting that the White House and the U.S. Capitol building are being evacuated this morning. Military planes have been seen flying overhead. Reporters at the White House were told to move to a more secure location. President Bush was not at the White House at the time. At the Capitol, security officers shouted to staff and reporters to, quote, leave, run. A guard in the West Wing of the White House shouted at reporters, go down into the basement. That is all we have on this right at the moment. If there's more information, and I've got the wire here up on the computer in front of me, as soon as there is anything more, we will pass it on to you. But again, the Associated Press reporting this morning that the White House and the Capitol building are being evacuated. And again, I should mention our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Susan Jacoby. She is author of the book Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, a book that was first published last year. At the beginning of this year, came out in paperback. So if you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore and look at it. It's published by Owl, and that is a division of Henry Holt and Company. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how over the sweep of American history this kind of battle between secularists, between free thinkers, and between people who make this argument that religion, and one religion in particular, Christianity, is sort of a bedrock foundation of America, how that over time has that always been with us?
Battle is maybe too strong a word. There has always been a tension between secularism and religion in America. And it, at the founding of our country, it was a very creative tension, because America was, of course, American people in the era in which our Constitution was written were not only largely Christian, but they were Protestant Christians. And yet, because they lived in a time, the framers of the Constitution, in which the worst horrors of union between church and state, which we've forgotten today, were so close to them. My heavens, at the time the Constitution was written, and all of the founders, who were all educated men, knew this, the last execution, public execution for blasphemy in France, had only taken place 10 years earlier. So these people lived in an era in which the disadvantages of union of church and state, not only for government but for religion as well. It's important to realize that the founders also saw separation of church and state, not only as the way to guarantee government freedom from religious interference, but to guarantee religious freedom from government interference. They were equally important. What we have with the religious right today is a denial that there was any interest in protecting government from religion. And that's one of the great lies of the religious right today. The founders were interested both in protecting religion from government and in protecting government from religion, because they lived in a world in which too much religious involvement with government had done nothing but bad things for people.
Well, just again, forgive me for interrupting our conversation, but we have had a little bit of updated information on the story that I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the fact that the Associated Press was reporting that the White House and the Capitol building were being evacuated. Now, a Homeland Security official has said that it appeared that a small airplane might have penetrated restricted airspace. And in fact, the most recent is that indeed these evacuations were caused by an unidentified plane in the airspace around the Capitol, that there was, at least at this point, certainly there was no indication that this was a terrorist attack or attack of any kind. So again, that's the information we have right now at the moment, that earlier the White House and the Capitol building were evacuated, and apparently it was because a small unidentified plane got into the Capitol airspace, and that's what we have on
right. It's not the first time that's happened, by the way.
Well, I'm sure that it's not. I don't recall this happening anytime recently, but maybe it's just as and it sort of escaped.
Not recently. In the first year, there was one evacuation of the Capitol with a similar thing. What's quite ironic is I'm looking on my internet news, which is also featuring a statement by Tom Ridge yesterday that there are too many terror alerts and so on.
Well, maybe this one gets our attention because the press corps was evacuated, and you know that,
of course,
that'll get us to worry. If our fellow reporters were in danger, then we're going to sit up and take notice.
Right.
Getting back to the subject of the founders and their attitudes toward religion and what sort of connection, what sort of role it should have in public life and should it be connected to government, I think particularly within the last, you know, maybe a couple of decades, I don't know, it's been something that there's been a lot of certainly debate and discussion about here in the United States, and it seems that that both sides have their favorite quotes, and you can engage in sort of dueling quotes about who said what when, and that either proves or disproves that one individual or another individual, either they were a person of faith or they weren't a person of faith, or that they thought religion should have a place in public life or that it shouldn't. It gets, for someone who tries at least to take the position of a somewhat dispassionate observer, it gets to be sort of difficult to sort out competing claims about just what was what, particularly when we're talking about events that occurred at this distance. Is it really possible, do you think, and maybe you do, that to say with some clarity what exactly the attitude of Jefferson and Madison and the people of the founders' generation were toward religion, and particularly this issue of what sort of place should religion have in public life, and what should the relation between government and religion?
I'm glad you raised that, because it is possible. It is not possible to sort out all of the founders' personal religious beliefs, because they wrote so much. It's exactly like competing arguments over who was the real Jesus in the Bible, the Jesus who said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God," or the Jesus who said, "I am come not to bring peace but a sword." The founders' writings were so voluminous, they're like the Bible. What is clear is that in terms of their personal religious views, the framers of the Constitution ranged from people who were very close to being agnostics or deists, who believed in some kind of God who set the universe in motion but meant human reason to be the instrument for understanding the world. Two people who, Jefferson, for instance, we know he didn't believe that Jesus was God. He wrote a whole book saying so. He believed Jesus was a very good man. But what I always say to people is it is not possible to know exactly what the major founders' precise religious beliefs were. What it is possible to know, and what we do know, is they did not believe in writing those religious beliefs into government. They believed in absolute separation of church and state. How do we know this? They didn't mention God in the Constitution, which was ours was the first government in the world founded upon the separation of church and state. And the fact that they didn't mention God, which all of the religious right conveniently forgets today, was fully debated at the time the ratification of the Constitution was debated. There were many conservative religious people of that day who were furious that the Constitution, that the preamble of the Constitution didn't mention God, and predicted that the whole American government would fall apart because of it. They lost that battle, the religious right did, and they've never gotten over it, and now they're trying to rewrite history. This does not say anything about what George Washington personally felt about his relation to God or Thomas Jefferson. What we know, what's important for us to realize today, is that they thought that whatever their religious beliefs, whatever the religious beliefs of Americans were, that it was best to keep religion out of government. And this is not to say, by the way, and I'm not suggesting that there's anything wrong with people in or out of government talking about their religious values as an important way to frame their views on policy. What is wrong is when religion is used as a justification for public policy. In other words, it's fine. I have no problem at all with George W. Bush talking about the importance of his faith to him. The problem I have is when he wants to impose his personal religious beliefs on government policy.
It is, now it seems to be an increasingly frequent complaint by people, by conservative people who identify themselves as conservative people and people of faith. And certainly there are liberal people and who are people of faith. You know, I want to make sure that it's not just sort of a one-sided thing.
And they're becoming more and more outspoken, too.
That conservative people of faith feel that they are somehow being discriminated against and that they feel that they are they're being told that somehow they have no place in politics. Do you think, in fact, that that is happening?
That makes me laugh. Let me ask you something. Could an avowed atheist or agnostic possibly be nominated for the presidency of the United States? No.
I think it highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. It's never going to happen in my lifetime. In my lifetime, we will see a Muslim, half Muslim, half Jewish woman nominated for the presidency before we ever see anyone who's an atheist or agnostic. Our politicians today are almost sickening in the implication that their personal relationship with God is the reason that one ought to approve of their policies. The idea that religious people are underrepresented in Washington, who is running Washington right now but religious people? And I shouldn't say religious either. Religious people of a certain kind. Of course, anybody who's religious in every way has every right to be represented in the government. But the idea that they are being discriminated against when, in fact, belief in God and parading your faith on your sleeve is almost a litmus test for high public office is absolutely ridiculous. What they mean when they say they're discriminated against is because of our Constitution, they still haven't been entirely successful in getting their religious views written into laws. As we saw after the Terry Schiavo case, the Terry Schiavo case demonstrates that a lot of Americans still have a healthy respect for the separation of church and state, and they were very offended at Congress trying to intrude itself into that case. And who was behind that? The members of Congress who represent the fundamentalist religious right.
Well,
atheists.
We're going to hear from some people here for a moment. We have some callers, and when we get right to them, then let me just again mention very quickly that our guest this morning is Susan Jacoby. She is the author of 6 previous books, including one titled Wild Justice that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her most recent is entitled Free Thinkers. The subtitle is A History of American Secularism. It was first published last year and then at the beginning of this year in paperback. So the book is out there and available if you're interested in looking at it. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go here to Bloomington, Indiana for first caller, line number 4. Hello.
Couple of comments. The Constitution does mention God. The very last words of the Constitution are, in the year of our Lord, 1789. Who would that Lord be?
In the year of our Lord, 1789, was the way that it, in the year of our Lord was the way official documents are dated. Just as I, when I refer to dates, I use A.D., which, as you know, means Anno Domini, after our Lord, and B.C., before Christ. This does not mean that I believe that Jesus Christ was God. And dating a document in the year of our Lord, which is the only thing the religious right has to prop up this argument, had absolutely no meaning, except it was the conventional way that things were dated.
It must have had meaning. They didn't say Anno Domini. They wrote out, in the year of our Lord.
That was the way important documents were dated. It has no more meaning than my saying A.D. or B.C.
You talked about the separation of church and state being partially to protect government from religion.
Yes.
As I read the Bill of Rights, it says Congress, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the free exercise of religion. So the First Amendment is to protect religion from government, not to protect government from religion.
That's right. You're absolutely right, and you make a very good point. The First Amendment was designed almost entirely to protect religion from government. The Constitution itself was designed to protect government from religion by specifically prohibiting any religious test for public office, by not mentioning divine authority as the basis of the American government, and also, very important, so concerned were they that there not be a religious test for public office that they specifically said, Article 3, Section 6, Article 6, Section 3, that one might swear or affirm to take federal office. Swear was understood to be swearing on the Bible in the 18th century. They put the word affirm in as an alternative for those who didn't want to swear on the Bible. You're absolutely right. The First Amendment is designed to protect religion from government. The Constitution itself was concerned with protecting government from religion. They go together in the minds of the people who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
If there was to be no religious test, how is it that when some of our Supreme Court nominees, that are, I'm sorry, appeals court nominees, President Bush's court nominees, are rejected by the, how should we say, secularists, the reason given is their deep personal beliefs. That's the reason they're given for being, how should we say, political extremists?
Excuse me, sir. The reason isn't given their deep personal beliefs. The reason is that they want to write their deep religious beliefs into law in a way that violates the separation of church and state. It has nothing to do, as you know, we don't have courts full of atheist judges. All of our judges, as far as I know, are Catholics, Protestant, or Jews. But what the religious right wants is judges who have no respect for the separation of church and state.
One more comment. James Madison, he was the chief architect of our Constitution. There was to be, religion was to have no effect on government. Here's what Madison says as the chief architect of our Constitution. Quote, before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. Religion is the basis and foundation of government. Here's another thing that James Madison said. The chief architect of our Constitution. We have staked the whole future of American civilization, not on the power of government, far from it. We have staked the future of our political institutions upon the capacity of each and every of us, each and all of us, to govern ourselves, to control ourselves, and sustain ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God.
Yes, and this is exactly the reason why you can't talk about the founders' religious beliefs from selective quotes. What I say to that is the fact is James Madison was the chief architect both not only of our Constitution, but of the Virginia Religious Freedom Act, which was the template for our Constitution, in which he took on people who wanted to support religious schools in Virginia and wrote the first state constitution that separated church and state. Our founders' personal religious beliefs have to also be viewed in terms of our government, in terms of the government they set up. And Madison was the architect of a government that separates church and state.
Well, I'm going to choose to move on. I expect the caller might like to continue, but this is what I was talking about earlier when I said
that's right.
We get so much into dueling quotations, yes,
Give the dueling quotation, and that's what I was saying. Madison absolutely did write this. It was a correct quote. There were points where Jefferson also wrote similar things, and other points where he wrote other things, which is what I say. All it need concern us today in terms of our government is the Constitution they wrote and the government they set up.
Hmm. All right. Well, I will go on here to another caller, and this is someone listening this morning in Eureka, so this is line number one. Hello.
Good morning, David. An excellent program. A comment and two questions, please.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank your guest for her most eloquent defense of the so-called persons who are allegedly being discriminated against. I haven't heard that put so well as I think the ruling class in Washington, D.C. is. The questions would be, at the top of your program, I was listening and then I had to go do something. You mentioned the name Robert Ingersoll of Peoria, which is close to where I live. I wonder if you could comment on him. And as I understood it, he was a great influence of his day. And secondly, I think she touched on it, but it seemed to me that Jefferson, Franklin, a majority of, quote, the founding fathers would have fit into a category, I guess, described as deists, where they believed maybe in a God who created things but was sort of a bit impersonal or had kind of faded from the scene. Could she comment on those two questions, please?
I'll take the second first, because you did. How dare you have left the radio for even a moment?
Yes, I'm sorry.
You did miss my speech on Ingersoll, but I'll take the first one. As best most scholars of Jefferson and Madison believe that they did fall into the category of deists, who were not atheists. They basically believed in a what they called a watchmaker God who set the universe in motion, but who then stepped out of the picture.
Uh-huh.
In other words, left us to figure things out with our own human reason. In other words, they believed in a first cause. It's also very evident in their language. Washington, for example, very rarely used the word God and almost always said providence,
uh-huh,
which was the deist word for God. So certainly deism was very much a belief. And by the way, John Adams also, in his correspondence with Jefferson, you can see also that he was also very close to deism, although he's not always classified with the others. In fact, his views on separation of church and state, although they had many political disagreements, were exactly like Jefferson's, as one sees from their correspondence. Ingersoll, I could go on talking for hours, and I won't do too much more because I did go over that earlier, except one of the things that I did mention about Robert Ingersoll was that he lost a major political career because he was an avowed agnostic. But there's something I can add for Ingersoll for people who were listening earlier. There's something else about him that's very important. He was also very ahead of his time in saying, and this is a question that comes up today all the time. I'm always asked, where do you get your morality or your ethics if you don't believe in religion? And Ingersoll was asked this a million times in the 19th century. And he said where he got his morality was from his belief that we as human beings owe every other person the rights that we would like for ourselves. In other words, what he was saying was to be against murder, to be against all of the things that any decent person is against, all you have to do is have respect for the humanity that you feel and want recognized in yourself. And he was also ahead of his time in other ways. At a time when people thought beating up children was the right of every parent, one of the lectures he made around the country was lectures opposed to what would be called child abuse today, and what an appalling misuse of parental power it was to beat up children. He was an opponent of the death penalty at a time when very few people did, and not an opponent of these things because he believed in God in the afterlife, but because he believed that the death penalty coarsened us as human beings in a society if we had the government execute people. So one of Ingersoll's importance is that he spoke to an issue which is very much with us today, which is which is, does morality have to derive only from religion? I mean, what does it matter, for instance, the Ten Commandments, prohibition against murder predated the Ten Commandments, and they exist in every society, because any rational human being knows that a society that allows people to go around killing one another is not a society in which we can live.
May I ask one more follow-up, please?
Sure.
What office did Ingersoll run? The Senate?
Ingersoll was the lieutenant governor, and he was appointed lieutenant governor. He ran for lieutenant governor of Illinois and lost, and he never ran for office again. By the time he ran and lost, it was getting around that he was an agnostic.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you're interested in reading more on this subject or finding out more about Robert Greene Ingersoll, you can look at the book that we have talked about by our guest this morning, Susan Jacoby. The book is titled Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. It was first published last year, came out at the beginning of this year in paperback, published by OWL, which is a division of Henry Holt. Just let me again tell you a little bit more about our guest. She is an award-winning independent scholar and writer. She has authored 7 books, including one titled Wild Justice, The Evolution of Revenge, which was a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. She started out her career as a reporter for The Washington Post and has contributed articles to a number of different publications, including The New York Times, The Nation, AARP Bulletin, Newsday, TomPaine.com. She makes her home in New York City, where she is also involved in the Center for Inquiry in Metro New York. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, given the fact that maybe something like the Ten Commandments, we might argue, aside from those things that specifically referred to Judeo-Christian religious ideas, I mean, if it's really grounded in a certain common sense way of dealing with other people that even secularists could agree to, if then someone decides they want to put up a monument with the Ten Commandments on the front of the courthouse downtown, is that something that we really should be all that worried about?
Oh, I think that we should be worried any time, because the Ten Commandments are specifically a part of Judeo-Christian tradition. If you put the Ten Commandments in a courthouse, let's say, or you require people to swear on the Bible, which most people don't realize it's not a requirement. It's just a custom. You're not required to do it to sit on a jury or anything like that. When we do those things, we are saying that this church and our state are very, very close together. And I've heard people say, by the way, that, well, what's the problem? We put up a copy of the Quran also, and a copy of various sayings of the Buddha and so on. Well, that takes up a lot of space. I mean, we wouldn't have room for courtrooms if we put all of the religious sanctions that are behind morality. And really, this thing about the Ten Commandments monuments—it's not about that. If you don't have the Ten Commandments, it somehow means that your courts aren't upholding morality. It is about the religious right for the people who are pushing all of the Ten Commandments cases, wanting to assert their political power. That's what it's about. Do I really care if I stumble across a Ten Commandments monument in a park? No. Do I think that these things belong? Do I think that crosses belong on the walls in public schools? No. Do I think that Stars of David belong on the walls in public schools? No. Do I think that the Crescent belongs on the walls of public schools? No. Because we are a country, a government founded on separation of church and state. These symbols, these religious teachings, beliefs about the religious origins of morality, they are to be taught by home and church, as they have been for centuries, as the framers of our Constitution intended. And one of the things that really puzzles me about the religious right's determination in these matters is, why do they think that the influence of their home and their church is so weak that they need to have these things in public spaces? I mean, I'm sure I was brought up as a Catholic, and I'm sure that it never occurred to my parents that when we went to public school, because the Catholic schools were deficient in science education, happen, I'm sure it never occurred to them that it was the function of the public school to continue to teach me religion. It was their function. It was the function of the church we went to.
Well, let's take another call. Someone on a cell phone on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I hope this question hasn't been asked. I've been listening intermittently. I just want her idea on the current administration's efforts to stack the Supreme Court and what that's going to mean for the future of our country to have right-wing conservatives on the court.
Well, actually, we do have lots of right-wing conservatives on the court now. The majority of the federal judiciary has been appointed by Republican presidents during the past 20 years. But this battle over the judges, I think it's extremely important, and I only read the same newspaper stories that you all read. I don't know how the votes are going to come out. But one thing that's very important about this is it's not about conservative judges. In fact, I'm giving a kind of long answer to your question, but the Terry Schiavo case is very important on this. When Congress tried to turn this issue over to the federal courts, they clearly thought, the right-wing conservatives, religious conservatives, thought that because so many of the judges on the Supreme Court and in the federal appeals court that heard this case had been appointed by Republican administrations, and in fact judges who were noted for conservatism, they thought they were just going to roll over and decide the way the religious right members of Congress wanted them to decide. When they didn't, when they said, oh no, this is not a proper role for a court, the lower courts have heard all the evidence, then suddenly the religious right becomes enraged because those judges, conservative judges appointed by conservative Republican presidents, didn't go along with their idea of rubber stamping on the Schiavo case with their religious views. What these people want is not just conservative judges. In fact, it's only about one-tenth of President Bush's appointments that have been held up by Democrats. They want judges who represent their extreme religious conservatism as well. Their attacks on Justice Anthony Kennedy, for example, who is a Catholic member of the Supreme Court, but because he hasn't gone along with their views on anti-sodomy laws and so on, are absolutely disgraceful. What they want is not just religious judges, but judges who believe in their brand of religion. And it's not a matter of political conservatism. Justice Kennedy is, in fact, quite a politically conservative judge himself, appointed by a Republican president. But he doesn't go along with the far religious right. So let's make no mistake about it. We're not talking about conservative judges. We're talking about fundamentalist right-wing religious judges.
All right, thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller here, line 1, Urbana. Hello.
That would be me?
Yes.
Indeed. Just one question for you. The question of school children and, predominantly high school children, being able to wear crosses, Stars of David, and expressing their religious beliefs on a T-shirt and not being allowed to do that in, like, the high schools and sort. And that would be it, actually.
Why do you think that school children aren't being allowed to wear crosses in high schools?
I have no idea on that.
Well, okay, they are. What you may have confused is something very important. Children are perfectly free to wear crosses and religious symbols. Teachers, however, are not free to stand up in religious garb and talk. In other words, a teacher can wear a cross, but a teacher can't, for example, put a cross on her blackboard. But that's a different thing. But the Constitution guarantees all of us, students and non-students alike, the right to wear any religious symbols we want. What you may be thinking of, and I'm glad you really asked this question, is the dispute in France over Muslim students wearing Muslim headscarves, which the government has prohibited in France. Now, such a prohibition in America would be absolutely an unconstitutional interference with freedom of religion. And here is a great proof of the genius of the framers of our Constitution. The reason that we could never have a law prohibiting students from wearing crosses or Muslim headscarves or Stars of David or whatever religious symbol they want is because our Constitution does guarantee separation of church and state. The reason the French are so concerned about this is, although France is a much more secular country in terms of people's religious views than the United States is, it also has a very long tradition of fear of what religious involvement in the state can do, based on their own history in which the Catholic Church, until the French Revolution, ran the state and persecuted Protestants and so on. Remember, I mentioned that the last execution for blasphemy in France took place only 10 years before the American Revolution. And so that in France, because they don't have a strict constitutional separation of church and state, they can have a law like this preventing the wearing of headscarves, whereas here it's our constitutional separation of church and state, which says the government could never tell a student not to wear a cross or a religious symbol.
I guess my point was actually T-shirts and the like, saying that God is love and like that, aren't. In Champaign County, I know the school systems, they frown on this and.
Don't they frown on other kinds of T-shirts, too?
Yes, indeed.
I think the T-shirt issue is a whole different thing. I know a lot of schools where all T-shirts with messages on them are banned because some of the messages are, let us say, you couldn't repeat them on a radio program. I think a lot of schools ban T-shirts altogether. It would be completely unconstitutional to ban the wearing of crosses and Stars of David's, and I'm sure that they don't do that in Champaign County.
Thank you.
But they may ban a lot of T-shirts.
Thanks for the call.
I'm kind of all for that. I think they ought to put kids back in ties and jackets and shirts, too.
Well, Lynn, I guess, though, that this is sort of getting us off into a side issue, but I guess I would think that it would be to say that a student could not wear a T-shirt that said, "I love Jesus," it seems to me that would be clearly unconstitutional, and that you might actually, if they wanted to wear a T-shirt that said, "I love Hitler," I'm kind of thinking, isn't that also a violation of the First Amendment to say you can't do that?
You know, this is getting off on a little tangent, and I don't know what the exact policy is in Champaign County. If you only ban T-shirts saying "I love Jesus," it would clearly be unconstitutional on a lot of grounds.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of schools just ban the wearing of all T-shirts with messages on grounds of school discipline. And actually, the whole question of students' free speech rights, and that's what we're not talking about freedom of religion.
Right.
We're really talking
right.
about free speech. In terms of keeping order in the schools, whereas you or I could walk down the street and wear a T-shirt saying "I love Hitler," if you're, it's a well-accepted principle of law that minor children in schools do not have all of the same free speech rights that we all do in society at large when we're over 18 years old. I mean, personally, if I were a school principal in high school, I would ban the wearing of all T-shirts with messages on them for just the reason that you suggest, that you can't have people going around with T-shirts saying "I love Hitler" in schools, or "I hate blacks," for instance, which is also an issue that's come up in schools. So a lot of schools, you know, feel the flashpoint of these things for adolescents who, let's say, whose emotions are not exactly under good adult control, have just banned the wearing of all T-shirts with messages. I'll bet if you look into it, you'll find that Champaign County does not ban T-shirts with one kind of messages. It just says you can't wear message T-shirts, period, to school.
Okay. Well, as I said, and you said, that's another show.
Right.
That's another show entirely. We have some other callers here. Let's go to line number 2 next in Champaign.
That's
hello.
Me.
Yes.
I just want to say, this is a comment, not the question. Go, girl, go. You are on message. Thanks very much.
I love Central and Southern Illinois.
Well, I'm sure not everyone would think that,
but
probably some significant number of people would certainly want to agree. Well, all right, we'll just go to the next caller, and that would be Champaign in line 3. Hello.
As Rush Limbaugh's callers would say, ditto to the views of the last caller. Could you please give your views on the refusal of the neocon administration to federally fund stem cell research?
Stem cell research is a perfect example of the imposition of particular religious beliefs on public policy. Now, we have people in America who sincerely are opposed to embryonic stem cell research because they regard it as a form of abortion, and they believe that abortion is morally wrong. And they certainly have the right to that view. But as extensive public opinion surveys have shown, most people are in favor, the majority of Americans of all religions are in favor of stem cell research. They want this explored. They do not regard four to five day embryos in a test tube, embryos which are going to be thrown out, which are just going to waste, as the equivalent of human beings, and they do not regard it as a form of abortion. But in fact, President Bush made a decision that we, a really comical decision, actually, from one point of view, in which he tried to compromise and said, well, stem cells that were in existence in the fertility clinics before August 9th, 2001, when he announced this sacred decision, you can use for research, but no new embryos afterwards. Another kind of a very hair-splitting decision. And what we've seen is states revolting. I believe also Illinois is considering funding stem cell research itself, too. Most famously, California in the last election authorized $3 billion of tax money over the next 10 years for stem cell research. People don't agree with that, but in fact, it's a great example of particular religious doctrine. And I don't have any lack of respect for that religious doctrine, but President Bush's decision was based on his religious views and also the views of the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church, also not shared by the majority of American Catholics, saying, you can't conduct this research because my religion is opposed to it.
Yeah, I think of all his decisions based on religion, that's probably the most detrimental, in my view, of all of them. And to me, blastulas are certainly
blastocysts.
Blastocysts, yeah.
That's what they're called.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye.
You make the point, I think, Mr. Covey, that throughout American history that secularists have been very important in reform movements at various times. I think some people might be prepared to argue, though, that religious people have also been very important in reform movements. For example, the movement against slavery and the civil rights movement.
It's religious people have been. I never said that secularists were the most important in those movements. I said their importance has been understated. Secularists in the civil rights movement, for instance, to use a more recent example, combined with people of religious faith, most notably the black churches of the South, to establish a moral consensus. And here is my point simply. The laws banning racial segregation and the attack on segregation led by the black churches of the South and joined in by both secular and liberal religious people are an example of the fact that when you put moral values into public policy, you have to achieve a consensus that runs counter to some religions and transcends religions in a way. There were many right-wing religious people at the time who were completely opposed to the civil rights movement. And the reason civil rights ultimately won out was the achievement of a moral consensus that could be supported by people of many religions or no religion. And the proper place for religion and social movements is exactly in the way the civil rights movement, which was not a government movement. The civil rights movement wound up affecting the government with things that we could all agree on, whatever our religious beliefs. And here's a thought of all these people who want faith-based money for churches. How free would the black churches of the South have been to lead the civil rights movement if they had been on a government dole at that time? There's the heart of the matter about why union of church and state is bad for religion as well as government. They were free to press their moral views within society and to offer their moral views as something that people of many religions or no religion could debate and discuss, precisely because they were not supported by the government.
Do you think that people throughout American history who would identify themselves as free thinkers or secularists or agnostics, or if they were brave enough as atheists, that part of the reason that they had a difficult time was that simply that they were swimming against the tide, and people who do that have a rough time?
Yes. But also, ironically, there's a particular thing. In Europe, for instance, it's no... I mean, I love the word free thinker, because that implies a lot of things. It doesn't necessarily mean you're an atheist. It means just what it says, free and thought. And the combination of free and thought, to me, embodies the most noble parts of our heritage. And we were just lucky that so many free thinkers, whatever they believed about God or not, had a hand in the foundation of this government. But to the extent that free thinkers have had a rough time in America, ironically, it's partly because of the separation of church and state that they championed, because the separation of church and state has enabled all kinds of religions to flourish here in a way that in countries where there was union of church and state, they never did. You know, in Europe, if, for example, you were opposed to the domination of the government by the Catholic Church, often you would become an atheist, opposed to both political and religious authority. But here, people who opposed the dominant religion, which was Protestantism of various kinds, didn't have to become opposed to the political system. They expressed their religious views by going off and founding another church, which was perfectly okay in America, which it wasn't in a lot of the countries of Europe.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. For people who want to read more from our guest, look for the book we've mentioned. It's titled Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism by our guest, Susan Jacoby.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.